This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. This week, a new film about Aretha Franklin hits the theaters, and it's called, what it should be called, Respect. What you want, baby, I got. Aretha Franklin was the queen of soul, the greatest voice of her generation, bar none. She was an 18-time Grammy winner, whose career spanned five decades. She was also famously private, which made producing a biopic a little more challenging. The job of telling Aretha's story went to director Liesl Tommy, who comes from the theater. Tommy has directed musicals and plays, and she was nominated for a Tony in 2016. She's also directed episodes of TV shows, including The Walking Dead and Jessica Jones. But Respect is her first feature film.
I have to ask, I mean, so your first film you choose, you know, just sort of as a warm-up, kind of, you just decide to take on this very small, obscure subject, Aretha Franklin.
Liesl Tommy spoke the other day with the staff writer, Vincent Cunningham.
So I just wanted, like, I would just love to know how this film becomes your debut. Like, how, I mean, what was the process? How did you become the director of this film?
It does seem crazy. I spent a lot of time during COVID talking to students, and I just kept on saying, "There, I don't. What I did was not normal. Don't think that this is a way to live your life." but the truth is that someone gave the studio my name as a person that they should be in touch with. And it was just supposed to be a chat, a kind of getting to know you chat. But I was so excited at the thought of talking about Aretha Franklin because I love her so much and I have loved her since I was a small child that I just mapped out the entire movie in my head. And then when I got on the phone, I didn't really do any chit-chatting. I just went right for my idea of what the film should be. And I told them the songs that I thought it should be. I told the tagline. They were definitely surprised that I had the entire movie mapped out in the first call. But then they came back to me and they said, "We really love this pitch and we want to start with you and this vision and, you know, and make that movie." And so, you know, I brought a writer on, Tracy Scott Wilson, who I've worked with, you know, in theater for many, many years. That's the movie she wrote, that's the movie I shot, and that's the movie that is going to be out in theaters shortly.
You grew up in South Africa, and you said you've loved her music since you were a child. What was your view of this singer that was kind of reaching across the oceans to you?
You know, that's such a good question, because I don't think I ever thought of her as American. I thought of her as a woman that I wanted to grow up to be. So, you know, I was a very dramatic and sensitive child. And so I love to sing her music at the top of my voice. you know, the ones where she's just saturated in heartbreak, to the power ballads, to like the saucy Dr. Feelgood, even though I didn't really know what that meant. This, you know, the sexual innuendo, Dr. Feelgood.
Yeah. But you don't have to. Yeah.
I know. I love the way it sounded, and I love the way I felt when I sang her stuff. You know, yeah. And I'm talking like 5, 6, 7-year-old me. And what I got out of it as a girl child is that one day I can grow up to be a lady who would have deep feelings the way Aretha Franklin had deep feelings. I would feel that in love. I would feel that heartbroken. I would feel that powerful. I would feel that vulnerable. And I was just like, I can't wait to be a grown-up and be able to feel all of the things that are in these songs. Because even if I don't understand the feelings specifically, I understand how the way she sang them made me feel. And that was just excited to be alive.
Speaking of your sensitive childhood, you wanted to be on Broadway from when you were a child. That this, you know, and that's what I think of Broadway, especially when you think about musicals, is that like there's this music that is attached intrinsically with emotion and with drama and with story.
Yes.
Was that always kind of your aspirations of wanting to be an actor as a child, then, you know, becoming a director? Was that always kind of part of the deal?
And I will say, like, you know, as a child, I'd never been to a play in South Africa. That was not like the vibe of my family. We were, you know, we lived in a colored township in, you know, there was no theater going. Because I grew up in a very musical household, an activist household and a musical household. And a song that was played a lot, an album that was played a lot, was that George Benson album. And he has this song on Broadway. And I used to choreograph very complex numbers that I would teach my cousins and force them to present to, you know, aunties and uncles. There was just this kind of a dream of a way of living that embedded early.
Right. Really? I mean, I didn't know that your family were activists, as you just laid out. I mean, what was it like to be someone interested in the arts in the middle of a family that was so interested in politics? Was that something aside from or an escape from that milieu? Or was it always obvious to you that they could somehow work together?
This is a very good question. You know, my family immigrated to the States when I was 15, and we moved to Newton, Massachusetts. And that's when I started doing plays. That's when I discovered theater. However, you know, my parents are immigrants. You do not immigrate and make enormous sacrifices so that your kid can tell you that they're going to be an actor. Like that doesn't even process.
Not how it tends to go. No,
definitely not. And certainly not an African, you know, immigrant. Mm-mm. No, that's not, that is just not in the cards. And it was, and my dad was a Marxist. And so he very much believed that one must not be a social parasite. Mm-hmm. You know, one must be giving every single second of the day to build a civil society. And there was just a huge disconnect. He did not understand how I could be an artist, a theater artist, because of course he also thought that that was the pursuit of the white bourgeois. And he's not wrong, come to find out.
That is something that we can discuss too, but yeah.
So it was a struggle, but of course, like all struggles, that it made me stronger and made me very determined. And, you know, I had to really go deep and say, am I willing to fight this fight and potentially, you know, alienate my family? And in the end, the answer was yes. Yes, I was.
Yeah. One thing I was thinking about when I was watching the movie is how private a person Aretha was, and how pretty famously she didn't really like talking about her life. And your movie, obviously, the job of it is to put that life on screen with some good things and some pretty tough things. There are some moments here that I think will be pretty unexpected for the audience. And I just wonder how you think about making a movie about the life of such a guarded person and how you decide what should make it on screen.
Anytime you deal with people's real lives, you know, and in theater, you know, I've done a lot of work that is based on people's real lives. And you always are struggling to figure out which bits make the cut, which bits are serving the story and which bits are not. And so some of these more difficult things that, you know, she certainly did was not interested in sharing in interviews with people. I felt like there was a way to understand her better. And you had to understand her youth to understand her adult self, you know.
How is Aretha doing?
Aretha's doing all right.
Just all right.
Because in, you know, the normal biopic, it's like, you know, a blip, and then we're into the quote-unquote real stuff.
The poor child actor just has to exit stage right.
Yeah. But yeah. I felt like her childhood was so important, for her relationships. But also, I felt like it was important that we spend time with a Black girl child, that we understand her value, that we understand she deserves screen time, that we understand that she is worth our care and our attention.
You still singing at the Saturday night parties?
Yeah.
I'll say yeah. Yeah is common. Say yes.
Yes.
You enjoy it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Look at me, Ree. If you ever don't want to sing, don't.
I love singing.
No, I know. Your daddy doesn't own your voice, Ree. Nobody does but God.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but you are coming back to the theater next year, right? You're directing The Outsiders at the Goodman Theater in Chicago. I wonder, after some time away, whether you are thinking about the theater in a different way now. Has it changed your relationship or your thoughts about the theater?
I'm definitely looking forward to, there's a certain vibe that only happens in the theater. And I think it's to do with intimacy. It's to do with the fact that you and the writers and the composers in this case, because The Outsiders is a musical, it's based on the S.E. Hinton novel. You're in the same room day in and day out with this group of people and the cast. And it just becomes this, it's a little like a cult. You know, like it's like this forced intimacy. And then also nothing compares to the immediacy of the previews when you're just watching people watch it live for the first time. And, you know, in previews, you're not done with it. You're still working on it. And so it takes like really nerves of steel to sit in an audience full of paying customers and look at a thing that is incomplete night after night after night. You know, so that is just like a great challenge, and I think it's important. I think I'll always go back to it. It'll keep me humble.
Yeah. Speaking of, I mean, watching the people, we could return to your father's, you know, more or less accurate comment about the sort of composition, shall we say, class, racial, otherwise, of theater audiences, especially in America. I mean, I guess we've been talking about that for a long time, but over the past couple of years, it's become a bigger topic of conversation. How do we bring more people, welcome more people into the theater? I mean, from your vantage, do you think that there's been any kind of, I'm trying not to say progress, but I guess it's the only word I have available to me right now. And has there been any motion on that, do you think?
I think, you know, theater can be very elitist and very classist. And it's honestly one of the things that pushed me into film and television was that I just knew that there was just much more democracy in the eyeballs on the work that I was doing, that I was pouring my heart and soul into, and that I was asking usually Black actors to like really go deep into like really intense emotional places for a primarily white audience. I was like, you know, if I go into film and television, I can do that. And A, there will be millions more viewers, and B, the viewership will be more diverse. But that doesn't mean that I get to turn my back on, you know, a field that I care deeply about and that I know that I can, you know, be a part of just challenging the status quo.
Well, I'm wishing you those millions and millions of viewers for respect. Again, congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much, Vincent. I am so glad that you got to see it and you enjoyed it.
Oh, yeah, it was wonderful. I was trying not to sing.
Think about trying to do to me. Think, think, think that
Vincent Cunningham spoke with Liesl Tommy, the director of Respect, a film about the life of Aretha Franklin that's just out. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I'm going to turn things over now to staff writer Andrew Marantz.
So I have a friend whose name is Courtney Martin. She's a writer who used to live near me in New York, and then she moved away to Oakland in California. And right after she moved, she had her first child.
When we moved in, I would do what a lot of, you know, new moms and dads do, which is like strap my kid to myself in the ergo, walk around and listen to podcasts endlessly and kind of try to figure out what the hell my life was becoming and kind of catch up existentially to this thing of being a mother. And I would always walk by our neighborhood school, and it was a beautiful place. You know, this is Oakland, so it's just full of beautiful trees and flowers and just felt kind of abundant. But I was also like, wait a minute, like there's like no white kids on these playgrounds. Like, what's up with that? Because if I walk around the neighborhood, I see plenty of white families, plenty of white kids. And then on this playground, I'm mostly only seeing black kids, maybe some brown kids.
So a couple of years go by and Courtney is starting to think about where her daughter, whose name is Maya, is going to start going to school. And so she asks around largely to other sort of gentrifying white parents in the neighborhood and says, okay, so how do I do this? Like, where do I sign up for school?
You got to get in on these tours, and then you're going to go on the tours. You got to like get on the wait lists. You're probably not going to get in, but then you will get in. Like, it was just sort of this like convoluted process. And even at the moment that I asked the question, I was already sort of too late. And like a lot of the tours were already booked. So I was just like, oh my God, I'm already falling behind.
So the school you were describing that has these sort of beautiful playgrounds and very few white kids, that school is how close to your house?
3 blocks.
Okay. And then when you start getting this kind of whisper network advice from the other sort of like white parents in the neighborhood.
Basically, like if I were to get an Excel spreadsheet, which of course I did from other white and or privileged parents who were saying like, we've been through this 2 years ago, let us help make your life easier. This elementary school called Emerson Elementary would not exist on that spreadsheet. And then if I would actually bring it up, people would say something sort of cloying, like they're really working hard at the school, but it's just, you know, it's not a good fit. It wasn't a good fit for my kid, and it's not a good fit, that school. I remember being intimidated because on greatschools.org, it's a 1 out of 10, or was at the time 1 out of 10. And that was intimidating to me because I was like, I don't know a lot about how all of this is calculated, but I have a feeling 1 out of 10 is pretty shitty. But mostly it intrigued me. Like, I really wanted to get on the campus. I really wanted to understand what was going on. And I just became kind of obsessed with this thing about, like, here we all are, these, like, white and or Asian American, for the most part, progressive people who have moved here like I did, because I like to think of myself as someone who wants to live in multiracial, like, urban community. And then we're going to very specifically try not to go to the school with kids of color, have our kid go to a school with kids of color.
Courtney is thinking through some pretty big questions here. How can white people live in big cities without living segregated lives? Obviously, not all white people in cities are wealthy gentrifiers, and obviously not all people of color are poor, but American history is American history, and the inequities in American schools and American cities are very real. So given all that, when you're a white parent of young children, which is a category that includes myself too, by the way, where should you send your kids to school? These are exactly the questions that Courtney just wrote about in her new book, which is called Learning in Public. It's potentially slightly weird that we are two white people talking about the racial politics of education. I think you make a case in your book for why you actually think it makes sense for white people to take on some of the burden of talking about race in this country and why whiteness should be seen as a racial identity. But I just wanted to name that because it is a thing. And then I wanted to ask you if you thought, you know, various people in the book say to you at various times, don't make your kid into an experiment. You know, don't send your kid to a bad school, a failing school, just so you can feel woke or feel like you're doing the right thing.
Yeah.
And did that affect you? Like, did you ever think, oh no, maybe I am sort of using my kid as an experiment somehow?
I think it did. I did always have some instinct that, like, that was kind of bullshit because it's like, this whole thing is an experiment. I mean, all of us are experimenting. That's why we all have to go to therapy when we grow up, is that, like, none of us as parents know what the hell we're doing, and we're just trying. Like, what we feed our kid is an experiment. Where we live is an experiment. Who we befriend is an experiment. Like, it's all an experiment from my perspective. So that, I think, had a little less weight for me. The thing that really, I think, eventually kept me up is, like, am I making my kid into a political statement? Am I, like, you know, performing my own political ego through the choice of where I send my kid to school? Mm-hmm. That weighs heavily on me still. And, you know, a lot of the book is about, you know, trying to say, as white interprivileged people, how do we, like, move away from the performance of anti-racism and, like, going to the right protests and saying the right things on social media and reading the right books and, you know, all these very well-intentioned things and actually live differently, which I feel like is most of what we have in the culture right now, is just so performative. And then I was reading this piece this weekend that was like, why, like, talking about race with your kid is, like, not bad for them. And it was like these different bullets that were like, curate your kid's library to make sure there are kids of color and encourage your kids to make friends of other races. And I was like, A, like, this is just so trite and, like, could have been written in 1982 or whatever. But also, like, that's so weird and exhausting to be, like, in your white life thinking, if I'm going to be a good person and if I'm going to raise a good kid, I need to find a black friend for them. Not to mention myself. Like, that there's this sort of, like, that is weird. Like, I would be uncomfortable. Like, that's very uncomfortable. And I think that is where a lot of people are at, where, like, their lives are so segregated, but they do have a very real moral inclination to do something. And so then they're sort of stuck in this weird gap of, like, what they're being told, which is, like, you don't actually have to live differently or, like, give up anything.
So, like, how did you think about whether you should follow the advice to sort of, like, write this school off? Or how did you sort of come around to deciding not to do that?
Well, I think it was a combination of my journalistic approach, which is I started to research not specifically this school, but the question around, like, integration and equity and, like, what do we actually know about what it means to have white kids on a campus like Emerson. So I ended up, you know, of course, reading and listening to a lot of Nicole Hannah-Jones' work, and then getting led to like this professor at Berkeley, Rucker C. Johnson, who's done this vast amount of research longitudinally and in terms of the amount of data about how integration affects kids, and learned that, yes, integration is the best tool we have for making sure there's more educational equity, that Black and brown kids, the earlier they're in integrated schools and the longer they're in integrated schools, do everything from like better test scores, better graduation rates, to living longer, to like having longer earning potential, like all of this crazy shit. And that white kids do fine and also have extra, you know, social emotional skills because they've been collaborating with and befriending kids who don't, you know, come from the same background as them. So that research was really convincing. But then I had to do like the emotional convincing of myself, you know, to like walk onto the campus, look around, just like say, how do I feel? How do I feel like my kid Maya would feel in this setting?
So, okay, so you wrestle with it, you think about it, and you decide, okay, we're going to send our kid to this 1 out of 10 elementary school. And as you write about in the book, you end up having a great experience. And, you know, you think maybe we're giving up on a little bit of educational advantage that we could get from another school, but maybe not. Maybe she's learning just as much as she would somewhere else. And yet there's this other element to it that's kind of awkward, I think, in the research on this stuff, which is often you'll read about how integrated schools lift up everyone, which sounds really nice, but there's a way of reading that that is like, you know, the way to save a school is to have white kids show up, which feels kind of like almost literally like white savior-y, you know, like the way, like once the white kids show up, then the school does better. Like, does that feel weird to you? Like, how do you process that?
Yeah. So, well, it was so interesting because part of the arc of this book is really me trying to figure out where should I send my kid to school. Then I think I've figured out that it would both be great for my kid and like ethical and like more moral to live in a multiracial city to send my kid to this Black majority school. Then I'm there and it's like wonderful and uncomfortable and all the things. And then my kid's transitionary kindergarten teacher, Mrs. Miner, who's this like brilliant, masterful teacher, Black woman, born and raised in Oakland, leaves the school after my kid's first year there. She was her teacher. And I say, hey, can I come like have a conversation with you? I'm working on this book and I would love to know what you think about it. She says, sure. She's building her own beautiful preschool in East Oakland. I show up and she said, did you mean integrating schools or gentrifying schools? And it was like, okay, we are about to have a real conversation.
So you show up and what did you guys talk about?
She just like said, she's basically very skeptical about integration. She's like, you know, my experience as a kid growing up in Oakland is that white people showed up and all of a sudden, like, you know, there's infrastructure and people care and like that pisses me off. And then we got into some really deep personal stuff, which was just like, in some ways, she thinks Maya, my kid, is a distraction at this school. Like she doesn't necessarily feel like it's like benefiting all of the kids to have Maya in the classroom. She's like, yeah, I mean, your ability to contribute books, paper towels, all of the like things that sadly a public school classroom can't afford is helpful in a very sort of basic way, right? But that from an emotional, from like even a spiritual standpoint, when she's got kids who like are dealing with all kinds of crazy shit and she's trying to show up for those kids, and then my like white daughter is like tugging on her arm being like, you know, can I get this specific kind of attention? That's actually distracting. And there's all these ways in which proximity is complicated. Like at our school, so it's like school provided lunch or your kid brings a lunch. Of course, all the white kids bring their lunch and they sit down and they have their, like, you know, in Mrs. Miner's words, their bento boxes. Maya's never had a bento box for the record because I'm a shitty cook. But like in theory, the white kids are showing up with their bento boxes and the other kids are having like school provided lunch and they sit on opposite sides of the lunch table, even at 6 and 5 years old. And like, great. So we like smushed them all together, but they're like separate and maybe even more aware of their class differences and what they're each getting that the other isn't. I mean, that started as one conversation. Then I was like, can I keep coming back? Like, are you willing to keep having this conversation? We would have it actually during the nap times at her preschool. So there'd be like, you know, 10 little babies asleep in her room because she, again, is masterful. And then we'd be in the kitchen just like hashing this shit out. And I'm just so grateful to her because we're honest with each other and we are friends at this point. I mean, she would say the same. Like, we have been in this, what I think of as kind of a democratic friendship of like, we are wrestling over some stuff. We aren't sure, like, and neither of us is sure about the virtues and limitations of integration. You know, her dream is to have beautiful Afrocentric spaces where Black kids feel like kings and queens, which is what she's created in her preschool. Like, you walk in there and you get it. Like, this is, she's built a world in this, you know, small house in East Oakland, but that she wishes the whole school district was that world, that, like, there was no question for Black and brown kids that they were deeply valued, whether white kids ever showed up or not. That's my dream, too, for Black and brown kids. That's not the reality. So tomorrow, when I have to send my kids somewhere, is it writ large useful to Black and brown kids in this city if Maya shows up at Emerson? I think so. But I don't in any way, shape, or form deny all of the like, potential side effects of that.
And also, just to get really sort of basic, and it's not that, you know, there's something about white kids that means that inherently by white kids showing up, they're improving a school. It's that the way that, like, white kids is correlated with the school getting resources, right? I mean, just to sort of spell that out.
Yeah. Well, and just to be very clear, like, our school, Emerson, which is Title I, Black majority school we've been talking about, raises privately, like from families, like max $10,000. A school literally like a mile away is raising $150,000 a year from their parent population. That's $150,000 more that those kids at that school get. It's invested in them. They get an innovation lab. They have a full-time art teacher. They have a library that can be open 5 days a week. Imagine. They maybe have like a nurse on staff. Like, these are real things that affect kids' real lives. So, like, there's nothing magic about it. It's, like, absolute bullshit. But it's, like, when white people show up, money shows up, and money makes a difference. Like, and, you know, this is, again, a, like, short-term versus long-term thing. Schools should be funded completely differently. Like, that is, I would argue we should abolish PTAs and abolish private fundraising at public schools. But until that happens, tomorrow, like, kids are showing up to schools, and, like, who's going to be able to donate money?
Totally. Yeah. Well, that's one. I mean, we don't need to go off on this tangent, but this exact thing is something we will be embarking on with our kids in, I don't know, a year and a half. And so I was like very close to it, knowing you and also knowing that I was going to go through this myself, this whole like process. And yeah, it definitely, I mean, one way of talking about it, right, when I report on the right and the far right, there are very many like disingenuous, specious ways that they like to critique progressives. Progressives are very easy to lampoon. But one of the better arguments that they make is around some of this stuff, the performativity or the phrase that you always hear, the phrase virtue signaling. And one thing that I was always trying to tease apart when I was looking through that critique is, what is the difference between, like, they call everything virtue signaling. But I was like, at some point, some things have to be not virtue signaling, but just actual attempts at virtue, right? And I think one of the things that you're getting at is that when you're only talking at the level of speech, whether it's social media or just like a big virtual room where everybody's doing nothing but talking and showing pixels of what they're thinking, then it's all virtue signaling because it's all signaling. But when you actually move into the realm of doing something, whether it's living in a different place or putting yourself or your child in a different place or spending your money in a different way or whatever it is, then you move out of the realm of signaling and into the realm of like whether what you're doing is perfectly virtuous or not. That's a separate question, but at least you're doing something, right?
Yeah, I love that way of putting it. And that also brings up another piece that I don't know if this helps, which is like part of what I'm wrestling with is the secular nature of like a white moral life, because I'm not a religious person, I'm agnostic. And like most of the context for like what a white moral life means contemporarily are religious based. It's like I'd meet Christian people And they'd be like, yeah, we're interested in living differently. Like, we go and serve coffee to unhoused folks in Oakland. We have real conversations with them. We're like doing these things. And I was like, that sounds really relational and like important and edifying and interesting and like so much better than like me figuring out whether I should post my black square on Instagram, you know. Wish I had some like larger, you know, sort of like discipline and framework to fall back on in this moral moment. I got nothing. I got like Robin DiAngelo and like whatever. It's like it's very anemic. Like, and so that, I guess to your point, Andrew, like the virtue signaling, like signal is shallow. And so how do I give this testimony as just like social proof that this is something I did, you might be interested, but it's not signal. It's like a real attempt at living a different way. But, you know, the beauty of the choice we made is Maya's in this beautiful community, which is not as highly resourced as other communities, but she has great friends. She has fantastic teachers. Her curiosity is being fed. There are certain things she's probably not getting exposure to in the same way as other kids are. I don't even know. Academically, she might suffer. I like, you know, the studies don't show that, but like my experience of her is that like she's not reading super well, or like there are certain things that maybe if she was at one of these highly resourced schools, she'd be like reading better and writing better. And I have no idea, but I'm really leaning into this faith that all of that stuff is going to come out in the wash. Mm-hmm. But like, the things that have stuck with me about my parents, who were progressive people who really tried to instill important values in me, were their contradictions at different moments of like, why did you say these things, but we lived this way? Maya will certainly say that about various things. But in this case, she might be like, that was kind of interesting that you guys did that. Like, and that intrigues me. That excites me.
Andrew Morantz is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and he spoke with Courtney Martin, whose new book is Learning in Public. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor at The New Yorker. Each month on our fiction podcast, I invite a writer to read and discuss a story from The New Yorker's archive. Recently, Ben Oakry joined me to read and talk about The Rescue Will Begin in Its Own Time, a selection of short fable-like pieces by Franz Kafka, which were translated from the German by Michael Hoffman and were published in The New Yorker in June of last year. Now here's Ben Oakry reading from The Rescue Will Begin in Its Own Time.
A large loaf of bread lay on the table. Father came in with a knife to cut it in half. But even though the knife was big and sharp and the bread neither too soft nor too hard, the knife could not cut into it. We children looked up at Father in surprise. He said, "Why should you be surprised? Isn't it more surprising if something succeeds than if it fails? Go to bed. Perhaps I'll manage it later." We went to bed, but every now and again, at all hours of the night, one or another of us got up and craned his neck to look at Father, who stood there, a big man in his long coat, his right leg braced behind him, seeking to drive the knife into the bread. When we woke up early in the morning, Father was just laying the knife aside and said, "You see, I haven't managed yet. That's how hard it is." We wanted to distinguish ourselves, and he gave us permission to try. But we could hardly lift the knife, whose handle was still almost glowing from Father's efforts. It seemed to rear up out of our grasp. Father laughed and said, "Let it go. I'm going out now. I'll try again tonight. I won't let a loaf of bread make a monkey out of me. It's bound to let itself be cut in the end. Of course it's allowed to resist, so it's resisting." But even as he said that, the bread seemed to shrivel up like the mouth of a grimly determined person. And now it was a very small loaf indeed.
So Ben, let's start with that piece about the bread, this loaf of bread that resists being cut. Do you see this one as an allegory, or is it just a loaf of bread?
You know, some writers are able to do that. They can work with a loaf of bread, and it's never anything else but a loaf of bread. But by the time they've finished, it is more. It's everything else. And he does that with this story. He's chosen one of the most central images in the human story, bread, food. A large loaf of bread lay on the table. I mean, just that sentence alone. Kafka, early on, had learned to see the world in these sentences that are tense, attention-ridden, dramatic, but very quiet images and pictures. A large loaf of bread lay on the table. So is it a loaf of bread, or is it the impossible substance of life? What do you think, Deborah?
It's everything this man has tried to do, or everything that man tries to do. And as he says, isn't it more surprising if something succeeds than if it fails? You know, that for me is the crucial line of the story.
Yes. That's a wonderful line.
We shouldn't be surprised by failure. We should be surprised by success. I also see, and perhaps this is me reading in my role as a parent, but it's interesting to me that we see this from the child's view. We don't just have a man trying to cut a loaf of bread. We have children watching their father, who is a big man in a long coat, who should be sort of superhuman in their eyes, and yet he can't cut a loaf of bread.
He can't cut a loaf of bread. Yeah, you're right about the parental aspect of it. It's terrifying, because, of course, Kafka is famous for his conflicted relationship with his father. It seemed to run through everything. It was the rip in the psyche.
Yeah, it's that moment of disillusionment, of seeing, well, your parent is not immortal. Your parent can't even cut this loaf of bread and feed you.
Yes. But then you try and it rears out of your hands and you think, oh my goodness, it's going to be a difficult life.
You wonder why they don't just tear it.
Yes, well, that's the other thing about the way Kafka makes his universe. He sets these lines and you really can't really go against them, because he's set a logic going that this loaf of bread has to be dealt with a knife. There's two things, bread and knife, are conjoined in a kind of relationship of effort and will and failure.
That was Ben Oakry speaking with me about Franz Kafka. You can hear more from our conversation and more than 170 other episodes with today's great fiction writers on the New Yorker Fiction Podcast.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Jonathan Franzen, you probably know him as one of America's great novelists. And his book, Crossroads, which comes out this fall, is one of the most anticipated books of the year. Franzen has also written some terrific essays for The New Yorker about conservation and nature. He's a huge bird watcher, particularly after he moved out to the California coast. A few years back, we asked Jonathan to take us to his favorite place to go birding. And he drove out there with our producer, Rhiannon Corby. It was a spot right near the ocean, but it wasn't quite as picturesque as you'd hope or imagine.
We are driving into Moonglow Dairy on a dirt road, which thankfully is dry. When it rains here, it can be basically just an ocean of manure. And a bird just flew across. That was a western meadowlark, one of my favorite birds, but I say that about almost every bird, so I can't be trusted. Huge power lines overhead, so we're painting a picture of a pretty industrial-feeling place. There's a power plant down less than a mile away at Moss Landing. We just went underneath, like, about 100 high-tension wires. I'm just going to park here.
My God, the sound.
I brought some binoculars for you.
We're about a half hour south of Santa Cruz. About halfway down Monterey Bay, which is a glorious, deep ocean bay known for its spectacular wealth of all kinds of life, particularly whales, octopuses, and seabirds. And branching off that bay is this estuary, which we are approaching, Elkhorn Slough. So Moonglow Dairy is on the edge of Elkhorn Slough. And we are in some of the richest and most intensely farmed agricultural land in North America here on the edge of Monterey Bay. And there's always high demand for manure, so the suspicion is that they make more money selling the manure than they do selling the milk. When I come here, I like to look for rails, and rails are very, very furtive, very narrow birds. The expression thin as a rail is not referring actually to a railroad track. It is referring to a bird, because they look, when you look at them sideways, they look like chickens or something. But when you look at them head on, they're incredible. It's like a chicken that's been flattened. And that's to help them sneak around in reeds and tall grass.
Can you talk about how you got into birding? I want to get a sense of why you spend so much of your time doing it.
Well, the short answer to the question of why do I bird, and here's a greater yellowlegs, can be answered simply by pointing a scope at almost any of these birds and saying, have a look. Aren't they beautiful? We're just standing here, basically doing nothing, and naked eye, I'm seeing 20 species of bird, each of them beautiful in its own way. Look at that. Look at the Forster's Tern just did it. It's gonna try, is it gonna do it again? Yep. Diving for little fish. There's always stuff going on, and you never know what you're gonna find. And whatever you find, it's going to be beautiful. And the more interested you get, the more interesting it gets, because you start to learn what these birds need, what they like, what kind of habitat they like, what their requirements are. And at a certain point, you reach critical mass, and birds become just a way of understanding the physical nature of anywhere you happen to be standing. You can get a sense of what's happening to the natural world, what's happening in the natural world, by paying attention to this portal, which is these very visible, very beautiful, very intelligent bipeds who are kind of like us. Let's see if there's anything worth. Oh, we have there's a Bonaparte's gull. Wait, is that an avocet? I think we have an avocet here. Yes, American avocet. which I'll zoom in on to see its wonderfully upcurved bill. It was only after I'd started to get some recognition for the writing that it became even an option to stop and enjoy myself, to do something just because it was fun, because it was pleasurable, to spend an entire day doing something just because it was pleasurable. That was inconceivable to me. But of course, I bring the same uncomfortable, obsessive personality to birding as I do to anything else. So I can get a little, you know, I can get very angry if I'm not seeing what I'm looking for. I can start to think, oh, this is not pleasure. This is an addiction. I can't leave it alone. I've got to go out. I've got to find a new bird. Bird watching is so grotesquely uncool. It's the last thing I need, something else to make me really uncool. I've written actually a lot about birds for The New Yorker. I keep trying to find new ways to slip it past David Remnick, who I really think couldn't care less about birds. Interesting, just flew there. I don't know what. There are a lot of flies. It smells bad. The light is fantastic. Lovely late afternoon January light. Oh, fantastic bird. Check this guy. Came out here for family reasons and at a certain point realized.
Oh my goodness.
That's all manure. Oh, that's annoying. Why I thought I'd keep going. Looks firm. But these shoes are never gonna be the same. Well, I sort of, we were skirting the edge of a lake of manure, and I was trying to cross a part that looked like it was solid, but that was just a crust on top, and now I've basically not only the entirety of the outside of my leather boots, but I fear the inside as well, not to mention my pants up past my ankles are coated with sort of liquid manure. Product of the hundreds of cows to our right.
Jonathan Franzen, who better to show us that pleasure always comes with a messy price? That was back in 2017. And by the way, we did offer to buy Jonathan a new pair of boots. Jonathan Franzen's new novel is called Crossroads, and it comes out in the fall. I'm David Remnick. That's our program for this week, and thanks for joining us. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino.
And we had additional help from Harrison Keithline.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.